I don't take defeat very well. It's a character flaw. I could never feel that it was something that I could leave easily. You'll have a group of people listening to this who'll be sticking pins in my eyes.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Ralph Bernard.
What was delivered to our house was a radiogram, and I remember the man who had the radiogram saying that in a few weeks' time there was going to be a pirate radio station. I just didn't know what he was talking about. I thought, I was 11, I thought, what's a pirate radio station? Because my experience of pirates was, people with patches over their eyes and cutlasses and things like that, and that's what I thought he meant. But then, of course, I heard the pirates, and Caroline was my pirate of choice. I lived in Essex, so it was very clear, very loud.
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
I got hooked into radio, I suppose, in those years. And music, of course, and pop music, obviously, was going through enormous changes at that stage. But it was the pirates that really influenced me. But then I was, along with everybody else at that time, devastated when they took the pirates off air.
You're listening to the final minutes in the life of Radio London.
But, you know, looking back on it, you know, it sort of morphed into Radio 1 for me, and I became just as hooked on Radio 1. I never listened to Radio 2 in those days. Tony Blackburn, of course. I remember Johnny Walker, who was huge in my life, both when he was on Caroline, and then I was delighted when he popped up again on Radio 1. And then, of course, he famously went off because he refused to play, was it the Bay City Rollers or something like that? He then went off to the States.
The Cade Brothers, and a time for us. Well, myself and my family will be going off to a new life with something that all the money in the world couldn't buy and that nobody can take away. And I'd like to thank you very much.
Years later, I ended up employing him. So Johnny was a big, big radio personality in my life at that stage. And indirectly, and he knows this story, is the person responsible for me meeting my wife, really, because I think this is a great thing about radio today. There's the most enormous range of music and opportunities to listen to all kinds of things that are going to take your attention. Music, speech radio, of course. And I can listen to Spotify and hear a great stream of brilliant music, and it is wonderful. But what I really want is somebody to tell me about the music and who's actually listened to it and can really understand. Johnny was one like that, and he said that there's been a great new album. I was a big fan of the Velvet Underground, and he said Lou Reed had got a new album out, and he started playing from Transformer. And at the time, I was off work because I'd had a car accident and I had a broken leg, and so I was recovering from that. And so I had it in a cast, and I was able to walk with this. And every week I would buy a new album, and I thought, well, on the back of Transformer, Johnny's recommendation, I'm going to buy Transformer. Hadn't heard it at all, of course. I just heard one or two tracks that he'd played, and loved it. Went to see, because then heard that Johnny again saying that Lou Reed was on at the Rainbow, which was the old Finsbury Park Astoria. That's where, on the way there, I was working newspapers at the time, and there was somebody, my wife was working on the same newspaper, and she, sort of with a group of friends, we all went together and saw Lou Reed and came back, and she and I got together. And we're still together 40-odd years later.
Satellites gone up to the skies.
I always wanted to be a journalist. I always wanted to work in newspapers. I had no idea about radio or anything like that in those days. I wanted to work in newspapers. I ended up working on a news agency, one of these agencies that would sell news. Didn't go to university, cancelled a course that I was due to go on, and decided, because all my friends were earning money. And so at the age of 16, I got a job and became a copy boy. You had to ring up copy takers, people who would type out the stories on typewriters. Remember those things? And you would file the story that somebody else had written. I was sent by the agency after about about a year. I became a court reporter, and there were two courts there, and I would have to dodge between both to pick up as much as you could, and that was all sold to local papers. So that was my initial grounding in writing. It was a pretty cutthroat existence in those days, because you were always trying to beat your rival agencies and getting up to all kinds of tricks to stop the agency or your rival being able to file the story first. I wanted to work on a newspaper. That's what I really wanted to do, because I thought that was the pinnacle. More than that, I wanted to be a sports reporter, because I thought that would be the best thing in the world. I got a job on my local paper. At the same time, I was working for the agency in the evening, because I kept working there. So I was doing 16-hour days. Never really thought anything more than just progressing my career as a newspaper journalist. It was round about then. I used to listen to the radio a lot, particularly at night, doing the late shifts in this agency, because there was nothing on television if you were working overnight, because it all closed down. There was, you know, bugger all on radio, other than Radio Luxembourg, and even that closed down at 3 o'clock in the morning. So if you were working till 4 or 5, as I often used to do, you could listen to a few things, but not much. I would love to be able to say, you know, I thought then that really 24 hours radio was what we needed, but it didn't occur to me.
Well, it is time to say goodnight.
I really hope you've enjoyed the music this evening.
One day, I got a phone call, or a phone call came into the office, and I happened to answer it. And it was from the station manager at Whips Cross Hospital Radio. And the station manager said, was there anybody there who would be interested in supplying them with a news service? And I said, well, I'd love to do that. I'll come along and have a chat. And I went along, had a chat, became part of the team. It was there that I learnt the first sort of real concept of sponsored programmes, because that desk, the Radio Veronica desk, blew up one day, and we needed to raise, I don't know how much it was, 500 quid or £1,000 or something for a new desk. And we couldn't think how to do it, and we decided we would do a 48-hour sponsored broadcast. We would keep going live for 48 hours. And I think I got a feeling it was my idea, actually, that we would go to local businesses and say, would you buy the hour? And we'd dedicate this hour to you for £5 or £10 or something. And so I thought, well, we've got to be true to our word here. We said that we would keep going for 48 hours. And so I kept it going. I just kept broadcasting. And then I was about to stop, and there was this knock at the door, and it was a nurse. And she said, would I keep going, because there's a very old lady who is listening to me, and she's not listening to anything else, and I'm keeping her company, and she's not long for this world, and could I keep broadcasting? The name of the lady was Julia, and she was very old, in her late 80s or 90s. I don't know what she was suffering from or whatever, but I found myself probably broadcasting just to her for at least 2 or 3 hours. And there was another knock on the door, and it was the nurse again, and she said, thanks very much, she's passed away. That was quite a moving story for me, because it was communication in its truest sense, and there was I, somebody who was living in the modern times, if you like, talking about my own life and life around, and wondering what it was like, you know, when Julie was around, who'd been born before radio had even been invented. I remember thinking, what a profound medium this is. It doesn't matter how you do it. It's an ability to communicate. It was about the time that BBC local radio was beginning to make a mark. It had been going for a few years, of course, by then, early 70s. And then we heard about these two new stations opening in London, Capital and LBC. And I was obsessed with Capital. I loved Capital in its early years. And both Capital and LBC, I think, had the greatest jingle packages that any company has ever come up with. Isn't it good to know Capital Radio? And
so on. And I can tell you the telephone number of the studio, which was 388-1255.
Isn't it good to know it's Capital Radio?
Listening to Capital and knowing a little bit about, quotes, broadcasting, having had some experience in the hospital radio, I wanted to work in radio. I thought this was a great place to be, so I sent off a few letters. There were hardly any radio stations around, you know. I wrote off to two radio stations. One was Radio Carlisle. The other one was Radio Hallam in Sheffield. Both came back to me and said, would I come for an interview and a voice test? I thought this was terrific that I managed to get an interview at least with these two companies. I remember going to Ilford Station and asking for a day return to Carlisle. I went there and I saw the manager then. He was curious he wouldn't, every time I asked him about the job, he wouldn't really tell me much about it. And I did the test, though, you know, and I did the news test, I did the voice test, and I've still got the letter that he sent me afterwards, which was something like, Dear Ralph, thank you very much indeed for coming to see me. I think it is very sensible for you to think about becoming a radio journalist. I'll be in touch soon. And I never heard another word. So, meanwhile, I had a much more engaging time at Radio Hallam, did a voice test. Hallam had by that time been on air probably for about 4 or 5 months when I went there. So we're talking early 75. And I waited to hear back from the news editor, who was Ian Rufus, and I didn't hear a word. I remember driving along a road where I lived, saw a telephone box, and I thought, I'm going to ring Ian Rufus and find out what's happened. And I rang, and he said, we offered you the job. I said, you didn't? I never got a letter. He said, well, we sent the letter to you 6 weeks ago, and I'm afraid it's gone to somebody else now. I was heartbroken. I couldn't understand. He said, we never heard from you, so we thought you didn't want it. And it was only after the event that I found out that the letter had, he dictated it, and the letter had been sent to Guildford and not Ilford. And anyway, subsequently, Ian said, well, actually, we might have another job coming up. Keep in touch. And I did. And there was another job about a month later. And I moved to Sheffield in the late summer of 1975.
This is Radio Hallam.
Its offices and studios were a part of the old Sheffield Star building in Hart's Head in Sheffield. The newsroom, there was probably 8 or 10 people, but actually thinking about it, when we obviously had a news editor, we had deputy news editor, we had an assistant news editor, we had a sports editor, current affairs and features editor. Then there were the plain old radio journalists, of which I was one, and there were 5 of those, or 6 of those, and then there was a newsroom assistant. I mean, we were hanging from the rafters. There was, when you think how many, but it was what was needed at that time, and you know, for what the sort of programming that we were doing 24-hour news. We did local bulletins through the night as well at that stage, but we were producing loads of features. We did a half-hour feature program every night. I mean, it was in the days of, you know, all things to all people.
There'll be interviews with people of interest in the area, ranging from politicians to pop stars. We'll keep you in touch with the traffic situation, the sports scene, and any other matters that might be of interest to you.
We did the news 5 to the hour. You get the news 5 minutes sooner. Although, as we often thought, you got the news 55 minutes later.
Radio Hallam boasts that it presents its news 5 minutes sooner.
You get the news 5 minutes sooner.
I've been to pick up my wife from a meeting, an open meeting. She was a journalist, and she was working on the Barnsley Chronicle. And she was covering, she was a woman's editor there, and she was covering an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I waited outside this building for a while, and so I thought, well, it's an open meeting, and there were big signs up, you know, come inside if you want to find out what this is all about. So I went in, but there was somebody there I recognised, and I thought, crikey, what's he doing there? I thought, this is going to be very embarrassing. Just as I was about to leave, I was spotted, And so we had this rather embarrassing conversation. Oh, what are you doing here? And, I've come for the open meeting. And I said that I'd come to pick up my wife. And she's not an alcoholic. Oh, she's definitely not. She's covering it. And I thought I would. And I don't know why I said it. To this day, I don't know why I said it. But I said, I've come to see whether there's material here for a radio programme. And this person said, well, I think that's a really good idea. I think that would be a great idea. And so I did. We put together what then became, it was a half-hour programme, which then became 5 one-hour programmes, which was Dying for a Drink. And I think it did have a significant effect on the commercial radio industry at the time, or so the IBA said. It was the only time that, if you like, a serious documentary had been made, which was networked, all except famously in Plymouth, where the programme director said if he wanted to put a programme about alcoholism on air, he would sit in the studio with a bottle of whiskey, and he never took it. Because I was quite heavily involved there with the union as well, I was the NUJ FOC at Hallam. The FOC was the father of the chapel, so the shop steward, really. I was engaged quite often in disputes, you know, as a negotiator on a national level, and I would come face to face on the other side at ACAS with the forerunner of the Commercial Radio Companies Association, was the AIRC, and the head of the AIRC, Cecilia Garnett.
What anybody looking at radio after its first year must be impressed with is the distinctiveness of the individual stations.
I got this phone call one day saying, there's a new station opening in Peterborough. Would I like to consider coming along as head of news and information? What she did was create a radio station where she was the managing director. She would have a head of music and entertainment, who was Stuart Francis, and a head of news and information, who became me. And between the three of us, we created, well, it was really Stuart and me. We put the schedule together and the programmes. I mean, Stuart designed the schedule, hired the jocks, I ran the news.
Britain's 22nd independent radio station has just come on the air. It's Heriwood Radio, based in Peterborough in Cambridgeshire. Heriwood is the first news-based station outside London, and it'll give heavy emphasis to news and information programmes.
I mean, this was 1980. And it was going through, it was just about to go through the 80s, early 80s recession, which was brutal because people didn't like radio very much in terms of advertising. I never wanted to be a managing director. I was very happy being involved with programmes. I was very happy making programmes. I loved radio, but I never wanted to actually run a radio station. Stuart and I didn't get on brilliantly with Cecilia. We got on well ourselves, but we didn't get on brilliantly well with Cecilia. I wanted really to move on, didn't have any particular ideas about where to go. It was Stuart who said there was a new station that won a licence in Wiltshire. Why don't we make an application, the two of us? And so we did. We made a joint application to go to run what was then called Wiltshire Radio. He was going to go as the managing director, and I was quite happy to be the programme director. Of course, then what happened was that he didn't get the job as the managing director, but I got the job as programme director. And he then became appointed the programme controller at Heriwood, and I was his deputy. It was the right thing for me to move on. And that's how I ended up in Wiltshire. But, I mean, all these jobs had to be approved. I mean, how ludicrous. Had to be approved by the... Well, then it was the IBA. I even had to be approved as a news editor. I had to go to London before being taken on by Heriwood to be given the formal stamp of approval by the IBA. I hired what I consider to be a great team. After 3 months on air, things clearly were not going brilliantly well from the point of view of the sales. The programmes were great. We're about to say that, aren't I? But I thought the programmes were great. But the sales were not coming in. Jerry went on holiday and basically never came back. And I was asked in January 1983 to hold the fort whilst they made a decision on a new managing director. I was 29 years old, was a bit bewildered by the whole thing, and I found myself in a leader position, waiting for the board to make a decision about future MD. During those 2 or 3 months, I must have done a half reasonable job, because they asked me to put my hat in the ring, and I said I would only do so if they allowed me to be programme controller as well.
And finally, a new independent radio station for Bristol, Bath and the surrounding areas is now on the air.
Down the road was Bristol, and Radio West had a less successful launch. It had undergone a fairly dramatic change in both management and its board, and it was pretty clear that if we could get together, this would be quite interesting. And so there were very early discussions about this that were brokered by one of our directors, who was actually a stockbroker called Piers Harford. And the new chairman of Radio West, who'd just come in, was Duke Hussey. And Dukey, as we called him, I mean, had a pretty stellar career in newspapers, having been managing director of the Daily Mail and then the Times. And he was quite close to Rupert Murdoch, as you might imagine. Rupert Murdoch had not long taken over the Times. And I think Dukey was more or less thinking about retirement. And he'd taken over as chairman of Radio West, and we held a meeting at the Castle and Ball Hotel in Marlborough in Wiltshire, when he said, basically, why don't we get together? And he asked a few questions of me, and I answered as best I could. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I was rather overawed by him, to be honest. But subsequently, we got on very well, and he said that he would put John Bradford, who was chief executive then and had been brought in, he would put John Bradford in touch with me. John and I had a number of meetings. We came up with the plan to form the first merger in commercial radio. And in fact, it wasn't actually for the first 2 years, it wasn't a merger. It was just a partnership. And John and I took the roles again. I didn't really want the leadership role. It wasn't something that I aspired to. He became chief executive and I was managing director, but he left. And then I ended up as chief executive of the whole lot. We were quite well thought of by the authority in those. They encouraged us to get involved with Bristol. I think Bristol had been a bit of an embarrassment for them. And they certainly liked Duke Hussey, because he was a bit of a name. Of course, he then subsequently went on to become chairman of the BBC for 10 years. We had been given quite a lot of encouragement to get involved with Radio West and then develop GWR. It was not too long, certainly within the first year, I believe, that we turned the whole thing, the combined unit, into a profit. And indeed, it became very profitable within 2 or 3 years. And we thought that this would be something that would be very good to develop. If we could do it with one company, we'd like to do it with more. We'll take you back here on the- We then held discussions with the lovely Bob Hussle, who was running Plymouth Sound in those days. And Bob actually came to me and he said he was running a tiny radio station. He called it tiny, not maybe. Again, you know, Plymouth Sound would be regarded as quite a big station now, but in those days it was tiny. And they had an even tinier station called Radio in Tavistock. They weren't allowed to call it Radio Tavistock. I had another authority rule. I have no idea why. But they called it Radio in Tavistock, just to see. And in fact, its strapline was, radio doesn't get much smaller than this. Bob recognised that there was no future in those days for stations of that size, and that he wanted to buddy up to bigger partners. He saw what we were doing. We got on well. And I remember talking to him about the idea of him merging with Devonair. And he said that's what they were hoping to do. And I said, well, perhaps we could put a group together which would embrace all of the Devon stations, so Plymouth and Devonair, plus the GWR stations, and that's what we worked to. And right up until the last minute, almost literally the last minute, that's what it was going to be. It was, you know, we held discussions with Dave Cousins, who was running Devonair, and very surprisingly and somewhat irritatingly, Dave Cousins, who probably never really liked the idea of giving up control of his radio station to his local rival, in that case it would have been Plymouth Sound, then made an approach to Capital, and Capital bought Devonair, and they, well, they made an offer and accepted Devonair. Now, you know, we could have outbid them, we could have gone with more money, but we weren't allowed to. We then, this all comes back to me now, it's absolutely preposterous. The authority then called us in, because we had to get authority permission for all this, of course. The authority then called us in, and we had to sort of, both Capital and GWR had to make a pitch to the authority, the IBA, for who would own the radio company. I mean, the idea that the authority would make a decision above the heads of the management and, more importantly, the shareholders, it seems amazing today, but there you are, they did. I was told, you know, I can suppose say it now, the late Peter Baldwin, I remember him saying to me that the idea of a single station or a single company owning radio stations from London, as it was then, we weren't anywhere near London at that point, but from London to Land's End, was simply not going to happen under his watch. So that was something which, you know, what we had to sort of live with. Capital was chosen above us. They bought Devonair, and then subsequently Devonair lost its licence in another quirk some years later, and Gemini took over, which then became part of the larger group anyway. So there you are. So we ended up then, we carried on with Plymouth. We had a lot of support, a huge amount of support from our biggest shareholder, who were also the biggest shareholders in Plymouth, and that was DMGT, who were fantastic for radio. They were brilliant shareholders for radio. And we floated the business on the USM in 1988 very successfully. Sadly, Bob Hussell died not long after we floated the business. And I asked Eddie Blackwell, who had offered me a job in just before I took the managing director's role in Wiltshire. He rang me and said, "You don't want to broadcast to sheep," he said. "You want to come and broadcast to a few chimney pots. Come back home." And because he was running Essex Radio. And I very nearly did. And then subsequently Eddie fell out with his board. But I said, "Why don't you come and work with us and come and help us out in Plymouth and come be MD of Plymouth? And then come and join me on the management team," which he subsequently did for many years. And he was a wonderful, wonderful addition to our team. Yeah, we were learning on the job. I mean, we just found ourselves learning that actually running radio stations efficiently was the heart of success. Efficiently meaning, yes, reduction in costs, reduction in duplicated costs, certainly. Forming a bulk of selling for national advertising was important. I had a number of people around me who were very, very supportive. Within the management team of the station itself, Steve Orchard, who was a presenter, believe it or not, he was a social worker to be, you know, in Oxford, and Steve Orchard was the first breakfast show presenter, and he was obviously destined for greater things. I mean, a brilliant manager, wonderful man to deliver a difficult message and actually take people around with him, but also full of original thought and ideas as well. And Simon Ward, who was, he was a presenter. He was originally a presenter on 2CR. He kept badgering me to do work in the promotions area. And then he got involved with promotions and sponsorship and then became sales director at GWR. And the three of us, it was a fun time as well. It was hard work. You know, I remember travelling around the country and in one of these executive buses, which had a sort of board table in the back, and there were the three of us plus support team. And we would literally go around the country to where our new acquisition targets were. I would do the negotiating, I would do the deals. Steve would talk about how we change the programmes and produce the new Hereward or the new this or the new that. I mean, it was formulaic. I mean, there's no getting away from it. It was formulaic. We did a lot of research, which was new for those days. We did a lot of music research. But more particularly, we were doing research into the segmenting of the audiences.
This Monday, a new kind of radio station for Nottingham. We're building it with just you, the listener, in mind. Help us make it...
Not long after that, the news came that there would be a national radio station on FM and two on AM. There then was the battle which David Mellor always claimed was his responsibility to persuade Margaret Thatcher that actually this should be not a pop music station. We then had this bizarre debate trying to find out or establish what was pop music. Earl Ferrers, I recall, said in the Lords that he could define it easily. It was any music that went thump, thump, thump. Now, very importantly, about the same time, or sometime earlier than that, another consortium called Classic FM had made a pitch for a London licence, and that was run by David Maker. They had investors called, they had Brian Brolly, who used to run the Really Useful Group. They had the Really Useful Group, they had the Daily Telegraph. They had four big investors and a chairman, David Astor. That consortium had just not done anything, but had just kept going. And so we were doing our own thing. We then learned more about the licence. It was quite obvious to us that this was going to be won by an application which could support a classical station. However, persuading investors to invest in a Classic FM type station was another matter entirely. We hadn't gone public at this stage, but it became quite public that there was an application from a consortium called Classic FM, who had a format which I believe was not going to be what eventually Classic FM became, but was certainly had content similar to Classic FM. The investors, one by one, pulled out of their consortium, and that it looked like it was going to fall over. At this stage, I had persuaded our chairman, Henry Meakin, GWR's chairman, that this would be a good idea to go for Classic. And I showed him the format. I played him the tape. I gave him the evidence. He said he would support that at a board meeting. Our board meeting rejected the idea. Henry, after the meeting, put his arm around my shoulder. He said, "Never forget," he said, "that no is merely a stopping point on the way to yes." And one by one, we convinced the rest of the board, and we held another meeting, and they said, "OK, we'll go for it." And importantly, I went to have meetings at DMGT, and DMGT supported it. It was critical. We then put an application together. I wrote it. If you go into my kitchen, you'll see on the wall is the original application. I wrote it with Nicholas Tresillian, who was the original chairman of Wiltshire Radio, who is a wordsmith. I put the business plan together. The numbers were looked over by by our bank. They had to convince the authority that we were going to be sustainable. Remember, this was not an application which was a beauty parade. This was effectively an auction, so the highest bidder would win. We had no idea who was going to bid for the licences, but we did know that Classic FM would have bid had they got their original consortium together. I rang David and said, "We're going ahead with this." And he said, "Well, we're going ahead with it as well." And I said, "Look, if you join forces with us, the two of us together would be much stronger." Literally, they had gone out and done research within the British public, and they'd spent quite a lot of money on researching that. And that was a really important piece of work because that's what investors would be buying into. The other thing they had, which was critical, was they had a great name, Classic FM. I mean, I would like to lay claim to that. We didn't. It was not our name. We had decided to call ours Gem FM. We met with the board, and the board was at that stage was just Brian, David Astor, and David Maker. We met in Flood Street in Chelsea, which was David Astor's address. There was Henry Meakin, there was myself, and lurking around was Robin Ray, who had been around for a long time and was involved with the original Capital and was going to be involved with the music. But essentially, the two Davids, Brian, Henry, and myself, conducted the negotiations. And we joined forces and we applied for the license. And we, you know, there are lots of stories about how we got the license in with literally minutes to spare. We couldn't get sufficient numbers of people to support it. It was last minute that we did it. The application went in. There were four applicants originally. One dropped out almost immediately, and for technical reasons, I can't remember why. The three applications that we knew of were obviously ourselves, Classic FM, and the company was it was a GWR company, but the name was Classic FM. Radio Clyde put forward an application for a mixed-based old Radio 2 easy-listening style radio station. And Chiltern Radio had formed a consortium for a company called Showtime. And the other two, to me, sounded pretty dire in terms of programming, but I'm sure they would have had certain success, perhaps, you know, in a market where which would be more developed. But for the first national station, I think it needed to be something special and totally different to anything else that was around. And we waited 6 weeks, and then I got a call saying, "Very sorry, yours is not the highest bid." That was a crushing blow, because I was so convinced that this was going to be a success and was going to be a major point in British radio history, not just, you know, commercial radio history. You know, we'd be at the heart of it and we'd be right in the middle of something very important. And we then were told we hadn't won it, and Showtime had actually won it. They had the highest bid. If there is this, if somebody says no, and I think the answer should be yes, I keep going until I try to get the answer yes. If it's ultimately no, and you know, many times that has happened, I'm massively disappointed. I don't take defeat very well. It's a character flaw. I'd love to be able to say I can rise above it all and just move on to the next thing. But sometimes it doesn't. It just gets to me, and I can be very, very disappointed for a long time. But anyway, at that point, I mean, I thought, well, you know, it's going to be something which may come round, but may not, and I've got lots of other things to think about. It was the summer of 91. I was on holiday, and a message came through from the hotel I was staying at, and it was Peter Baldwin, and he said, "Showtime haven't raised enough money." The irony was they'd raised 10 million out of 12 million. Their business plan showed that they had to raise £12 million, and they'd raised 10 million. We had to raise 6 million. And I thought, where the hell are we going to get 6 million from? He said, "You've got 6 weeks. So I came back from holiday. We held a board meeting. We got the board to support it. David Maker and I tried to get our respective groups to put money in. Really useful group had pulled out. Daily Telegraph had pulled out. They all, I think Carlton was another one. I think it was Carlton. They'd all pulled out. They all said they didn't want to have any involvement. And so we were stuck. And the most GWR could afford was less than 20% of the total cost. Because, you know, it was a lot of money. 6 million. There then was the most extraordinary process of getting Classic FM to air. We held a board meeting, a Classic FM board meeting, or the consortium board meeting, I should say. David Astor was the chair, and he said that his part of the consortium had thought that the best way of raising the money here was going to be by getting a bigger company together with more radio stations. And this was appalling from our point of view. We thought that, you know, if we start diluting, when we're going out to investors, when we start diluting the story, this is going to be terrible. And so we basically said at that meeting, well, you do what you think and we'll do what we think, and basically we'll see who comes up with the money. I put the presentation together. I worked with the bank, I worked with the brokers, I worked with DMGT. We were very convinced that actually the other partners were going to come around to doing this. And David Maker said, no, this is, you know, we're going to do our own thing, but we're not going to involve any other radio stations. So, we'll go out to our contacts. And I remember a conversation which said something like, look, you go and do your own thing, but for heaven's sake, you know, don't involve another radio company. Unbeknown to us at the time, but then as it transpired, they bought Jazz FM. They then put a plan together, again, unbeknown to us, what they called the macro deal, to put Jazz FM and Classic FM together in a consortium, and that the two would operate as a single company. So you could see the logic. It was, you know, similar sort of audience. I just thought this would be awful for Classic FM. David actually was a bit coy about that when that came out, and he said, no, it wouldn't be something that he would, you know, they were doing. And then one night, it was a Thursday evening, my fax machine in my office sprung into life. It was spewing pages and pages and pages of a plan. And when I looked at this plan, it was the macro plan, which involved the acquisition of Jazz FM, Buzz FM and Classic FM under a new banner. And we weren't even mentioned in it. And I thought, what the hell's all this about? And it transpired that it had been sent out by a broker or a bank completely by mistake with my number on it. When I rang David, he was, we are putting that together. And I said, well, you can't do that because we own this, you know, this is a consortium that we own. He said, well, we own the name. I said, yeah, and we have got the chairman. The chairman is David Astor. So really, it's for us to decide. And I thought this was outrageous. I'd written the application. I'd gone through all the hoops that I had. And I then rang Peter Baldwin. I said, who owns this license? Ah, well, basically, you said, essentially, you've got to sort this out between yourselves. And we then had to get an injunction to stop the authority accepting a completed application from a consortium which had not really won the license. It was a different group. That never came to anything in the sense that because the authority accepted our position, at that point the macro deal faded away. They had one key investor who was Time Warner. So they were going to be big investors in the new company. And they had a big decision to make. Time Warner had a big decision. Had they backed the two Davids, then we would have had no leg to stand on because we simply didn't have the money to go forward any further. There then followed an intense negotiation with Time Warner, culminating in the chief executive of DMGT flying out to the US to meet with Time Warner. And the reason that DMGT got involved was because they had a partnership with Time Warner, a publishing partnership with Time Warner in America. Following that meeting, Time Warner switched its allegiance to us. And there was this big meeting in the boardroom of all places at the Dorchester Hotel. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, we were scrabbling around for money, but Time Warner wanted to meet at, you know, the £10,000 a night boardroom at the Dorchester. And at that meeting, we came up with a proposal that David Maker, who could have been the chief executive of Classic FM, and David Astor could be on the board, and we would offer them 10% of Classic FM, and they could invest any time up to the first 6 months of Classic FM going on air. For reasons that I never understood, they both declined that, and we were then on our own, had to fight on our own to get the money raised. I did, not just me, but one or two others with me, did over 100 presentations to trade investors, newspaper groups, individual investors. It was just impossible to convince people that Classic FM was a good idea because they said, well, look, you know, we've got a national station, Radio 3. If anybody had thought it was a good idea, it would have been successful elsewhere in the world, and, you know, all the excuses. And right at the last minute, a bit like the application, I did a presentation through a contact of Henry Meekins to Peter Michael, Sir Peter Michael, who'd made a lot of money in his own business. And the great thing about that, I mean, I spent nearly 2 days convincing him that Classic FM was a good idea. But the great thing about that was that Pete, as he was known, effectively signed a cheque at the end of the day and said, OK, he didn't have to go to a board, he didn't have to go to anybody else. He made that decision.
Good morning and welcome to Britain's first national commercial radio station. This is Classic FM.
It was very exciting. It was in Oval Road where we managed to get headquarters, studios for £7 a square foot. I remember the leaders in the newspapers beforehand, before, you know, when we won the license, I remember one in particular from the Independent actually said something like classical or popular classical music, oh dear. The great irony of that now is that Classic FM has outlived the Independent. The following day, after our first day on air, the number of people that said this is something that actually is going to work, and the newspaper leaders were very positive about us.
I'm Nick Bailey, and this is George Frederick Handel.
We'd grown in size very considerably, and, I mean, there was a moment in time where GWR, would you believe, had a market capitalisation, its value, was £1.2 billion, and Capital's was £1.1 billion, which I know irked David Mansfield a lot. It didn't last long, but it was clearly during the dot-com madness. However, as life got tougher in the early part of the 2000s, you know, there was a lot of pressure on the radio companies to consolidate further. The ownership rules were so restrictive, you couldn't do, you know, remotely anything like people can do today. And then it began very slowly. We got out, you know, the industry managed to align itself broadly. It was a united industry. We held slightly different views about DAB and so on, but so we were able to convince the regulators and the government that we could be more flexible in the ownership arrangements. Inevitably, that led to pressure both on Capital, which had seen declining audiences in London, principally through competition, but also through, you know, some investments that it had made, which hadn't worked terribly well. It had a venture into restaurants, for example, which didn't work terribly well, and the city hated it. And so there was pressure on all radio companies to find ways of further consolidation. And so David Mansfield, who was running Capital, and I, we often had dinner together, and we kicked around the idea of a merger many times. And eventually, David and I did work at this a bit more seriously. We decided that the best route would be to go to almost like a marriage guidance counsellor. We went to an outside source, a person who was expert in this sort of thing. His name's Nigel Pantling, former head of corporate finance at Hambros Bank, who was trusted by both David and myself. Nigel held probably a dozen, maybe 15 different meetings with us, and eventually we agreed that we would do the merger. Valuation was something which was inevitably going to be a bit of a saber rattle by both of us, but we got there in the end, and Capital had the slightly larger share of the combined company. In the negotiation, there was, you know, a little bit of jostling here and there. David became chief executive. I was executive chairman, so in effect, we had two chief executives, which is never a good idea. You may well get a completely different version of this from David, but this is my version. David and I had a perfectly good relationship. It was okay. We knew that it was an awkward coming together, because you had two big companies, two, you know, standard bearers, if you like, in the industry. I mean, I think GWR had been trailblazers in a number of areas, and Capital was the more sort of traditional, in the sense that it had the biggest single license, had been, everybody knew Capital, and yes, Classic FM, everybody, you know, lots of people knew Classic FM, but it wasn't as big as Capital was. I mean, Capital was a huge station and was made, you know, at its height, was making an absolute fortune. And so you had these two companies, big companies, coming together. You had two individuals, both at the head of those companies, who both, you know, weren't going to give way very easily. And you had pushing us, if you like, together in the boxing ring. You had the city. It was an uncomfortable position. But nonetheless, you know, looking back on it now, with the benefit of 10, 12 years, 10, 11 years of hindsight, you can say, well, it was probably a necessary part of the process of evolution. You probably couldn't do it in any other way. You know, there wasn't going to be an acquisition. The city wanted it, and probably the industry needed, you know, you can look at what's happened since. The consolidation had to happen somewhere along the line, and so that's the way it happened. Where it developed from there was some months in. In fact, I can tell you it was on the very day of the London bombings. We rearranged the meeting out of London the following day. David presented a plan to me, which basically was putting Capital people in place of GWR people. I think David knew that I couldn't have accepted that. We then had to go to the board to explain there was a difference of opinion, and we each had to make a presentation to the board. And it was a bit like it was a bit like X Factor. We had to sort of perform in front of a load of judges, each of us individually, and put our plans to the board. And in fact, it wasn't 50-50, it was more than 50-50 in my favour, so I subsequently discovered. But DMGT obviously were big supporters and continue to be big supporters of me. So David, when you come down to that and you come to a plan, you can't just carry on as you are, and that sort of led to an end of that arrangement. And David left after, well, he was basically worked out a period of notice, which was a bit awkward for us both, I think, but it was 2 or 3 months he was there before we finally left. We had to make a number of changes. You know, we were under a lot of pressure. Had to make some changes to, to the budgets, which were huge. Revenue wasn't great. There was still a lot of turmoil and disruption that we had to deal with. Occasionally I get involved in programming, but you know, I was so far away from it. I was still coming up with ideas. You know, and Stephen Orchard and I came up with the idea of Planet Rock, for example. You know, we were in a pub in Marlborough in Wiltshire. We said, you know, we needed a radio station that plays rock music. We did this because there was a jukebox in this pub. And so I was still coming up with ideas, but I wasn't allowed, if you like. It wasn't possible for me to get close to programming. And I didn't like what I was doing and what I'd been. And also, you know, you get such a lot of criticism. I mean, there'll be people listening to this. I know, you know, you'll have a group of people listening to this who'll be sticking pins in my eyes, in dolls of me, because that's the person I became, the sort of hate figure, because I was the person who consolidated the industry and changed local radio. And, you know, I was once sent a coffin to the man who, you know, a little miniature coffin made of wood. It was sent in a box to me, and it was said to the man who murdered Radio West. Yeah, oh my God, you know, people really take this sort of stuff seriously. You don't like it, you know, especially the anonymous stuff. It doesn't get to you in the sense that it keeps you awake at night, but it's not pleasant. I mean, you know, you've gone into the industry, you're doing your best, you're not there to upset anybody, you're there to do what you think is right. And yes, occasionally, you know, you don't make omelettes without breaking eggs, and that's what happens in the industry. We had all these high-profile people. We had Johnny Vaughan doing Breakfast on a lot of money. We had, you know, Classic FM, high-profile Capital. You know, the troubled Capital, always called the troubled Capital, because Hart was taking it to the cleaners. And it used to really annoy me when every time we had, you know, the quarterly radar, our stock price, never mind what happened to the rest of the group, never mind, you know, the success of some of the other stations, if Capital moved, you know, a percentage, you know, a quarter of a percentage point, that affected the share price.
I've joined Capital.
Good journey.
Oh, the usual.
And the toughest time was caused by the continuous decline. I mean, you could almost map it from the time Richard Park left, when, you know, well before the GCAP merger. When Parky left, Capital's audience declined, and its competitors, Magic and Heart and so on, were doing really well, relatively. One thing that Capital had, which was really important, was it had its cost per thousand premium substantially over its London rivals. And I spoke to our sales team about that, and I spoke to Simon Ward and Duncan George, who was running Opus, the national sales team at that time. I spoke to Douglas MacArthur, who was running the REB, and they said to me, they reinforced the point, whatever you do, do not lose that premium. The moment you lose that premium,
you're buggered, basically. And so it was quite a shock when it was Duncan George who came to me and he showed me a presentation. He said, I've just been given this presentation by, it was a big London agency. The presentation was something like, this is what's happened to your audience over the last 5 years. And this is what's happened to your competitors. This is what's happened to your cost per thousand, therefore, as a consequence, because naturally as your audience goes down, if you maintain your premium, cost per thousand goes the other way. And it showed a graph line going from south to north. And we're not going to put up with it anymore. Unless you reduce your CPT, you are going to lose us as a consequence of that. Others will come off, and it was tough negotiation. It wasn't blackmail, it was just a tough negotiation. Change your cost per thousand, reduce our costs, or come up with a deal which will benefit us, otherwise we're going to pull off all of our spend. You could look at it now and say, well, it was a flawed policy, but it was the only thing that we could think of at the time when we had no other weapons to protect the cost per thousand. And I genuinely believe, had we not done that, then you know the revenue would have fallen off a cliff. And as it happened, it did protect the cost per thousand. It became too difficult to carry on for me. I wasn't enjoying it. Internally, I was fighting battles the whole time. Yeah, I mean, I still had support, and I could still continue, you know, arguing the case. But I put a lot of commitment behind particularly digital radio, and I was still having a tough time. I think people still needed to be convinced by that. I had the support, but then within the company, somebody said that, well, it was Fru. I mean, Fru said she was, you know, she couldn't support what we were doing and she was going to leave. And I just said, well, you know what will happen. You know, that will just put a lot of pressure on me if you go now. I mean, Fru had come in, you know, was running Capital and sort of head of sales. More than head of sales, I mean, we get a much more grander title than that, but I mean, she was effectively in charge of that. Her appointment had gone down well, and here we were some sort of 6 months or so later. This is not going to go, and I, you know, I can fight it. Of course I can say, OK, you go, and I'll have to stand up to everybody. I just didn't have the stomach for it, to be honest. I just thought, you know, the time has come when you've got to say... Duke Hussey used to say to me, if everybody thinks you're drunk, it's time to lie down. And I think, you know, I just thought, well, it was time to lie down. I could never feel that it was something that I could leave easily and just say, OK, I'm going to do something else now, because radio is such a fantastic medium. It's all around you. But, you know, when you've been part of something for so long and they're your babies and you've nurtured them and created them and, you know, it wasn't easy. I'm not saying, you know, I enjoyed it, but I had prepared for this by taking on other things. I do a lot of charity work. I did a lot of my own things. I was still running and playing football, and I 5 days, literally 5 days after I walked out of Leicester Square, I went on a 2 month sabbatical to South America. It was one moment in that which I always sort of think is quite funny. I was literally about as far away from anywhere as it's possible to be in that time. I was on Easter Island, and I don't know why, but I had my phone with me, and I'd been texting home or something like that, and my phone went on Easter Island, thousands of miles from anywhere, and it's Ashley Tabor. And my wife said, I thought you left all that behind. What? I'll just have a quick chat and see what he wants. Of course, it was Ashley telling me he was going to make a bid for GCAP, and what did I think? So, most proud, it has to be Classic FM. People will lay claim to owning Classic FM's authorship. I know in my heart Classic FM would not have gone on air had it not been for me. And so I'm most proud of that. I'm also proud of being at the heart of some of the changes in radio regulation, which I believe has been good for the industry to free up regulation. I took a lot of stick over that at the time. And I'm proud of what we did for DAB. I don't think DAB would be where it is today. And I think it's fantastic now. I can say it now. I mean, I was arguing
like hell against digital D2, but you know, we've moved on a long way since then. So I'm proud of what was happening in digital radio, and I think that the commitment there still, you know, there's a lot of money gone into it, and it'll be a long time before it pays back. But when it does pay back, it'll pay back well, and it'll be great for commercial radio. I'd like to be remembered as somebody who was passionate about radio and did what he thought was the right thing for radio as a medium, but also the people who worked with him. I mean, I'm very loyal to my close colleagues, and always have been.
Bernard. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.